Call the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee to order. We're going to go a little out of order here today and do our bill introduction first. So I will open a work session for possible bill introduction. Dr. Warner.
Madam Chair, we have a series, I believe five LCs in front of you, and I'll just go through them very quickly and answer any questions. The first is LC 1307, and what that does is it amends the kicker process to the corporate kicker process to put the corporate income and excise tax surplus revenue into reserve fund. It was a constitutional amendment. LC 1973 prohibits Department of Revenue from applying or interpreting any tax or revenue law retroactively unless it's expressed in statute. LC 2128 changes the mandatory minimum refund of overpaid property taxes to $10. This is at the request of the Oregon Association of County Tax Collectors. So we are introducing it on their at their request. LC 2129 is another bill from the Oregon Association of County Tax Collectors, and it allows counties to serve notice required of personal property tax delinquency warrants by means of one publication and by first-class mail. So it's just an administrative bill for them. The LC 2472 is permissive. It removes the prohibition against local government enactment of taxes on real estate transfers. It does not enact real estate transfers, but removes the prohibition for local governments, permitting them to do so. LC 2474 is a bill that we have an identical companion to in the House, but this bill was for work plan purposes. LC 2474, it expands the earned income tax credit that we have currently, increases the percentage.
Okay. Committee, I think just to remind you that voting to introduce these bills just gets them into the process and does not indicate favoring or opposing them. So I'd like a motion. Senator Haas, do you have one? I think we can do these en bloc, can't we?
Madam Chair, we'll need a separate motion for LC 21 and LC 29 because they are at the request of another organization.
Oh, okay. So why don't we just do them all separately then?
Madam Chair, I move that we adopt, for purposes of introduction, LC 1307.
Senator Haas has moved that we introduce LC 1307 as a committee bill. Any discussion? Any objections? So ordered.
Madam Chair, I move that we adopt, for purposes of introduction, LC 1973.
Senator Haas has moved that we introduce LC 1973 as a committee bill. Any discussion? Any objections? So ordered.
Madam Chair, I move that we adopt, for purposes of introduction, LC 2128.
Senator Haas has moved LC 2128 be introduced
Excuse me, Madam Chair. This would be that it be introduced at the request of the Oregon Association of County Tax Collectors.
Oh, it has to be introduced that way? Oh, correct, because we're writing that down. Okay. Senator Haas has moved that we introduced LC 2128 at the request of the
Oregon Association of County Tax Collectors.
Oregon Association of County Tax Collectors. Any discussion? Good. Any objections? So ordered.
Madam Chair, is this the same thing?
It's 29.
Same organization.
Madam Chair, I move that we adopt, for purposes of introduction, at the request of the Oregon Association of County Tax Collectors, LC 2129.
Senator Haas has moved that we introduce as a committee bill, LC 2129, at the request of the Association of County Tax Collectors. Any discussion? Any objections? So ordered. Senator Haas.
Is this also the same organization?
No, the other two are just straight committee bills.
Madam Chair, I move that we adopt, for purposes of introduction, LC 2472.
Senator Haas has moved that we introduce LC 2472 as a committee bill. Discussion, objection, so ordered.
Madam Chair, I move, for purposes of introduction, LC 2474.
Senator Hass has moved that we introduce LC 2474 as a committee bill. Any discussion? Objections? So ordered. Good work, Senator Hass. Thank you. Okay, now we will open a informational meeting to discuss school finance overview. Steve Meyer, thank you for coming.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. For the record, Steve Meyer, Legislative Revenue Office. This afternoon, we're going to look at school finance and concentrate primarily on the distribution of state school fund dollars, what determines and what factors determine how much each school district and each ESD gets out of that total. And then that will be the main focus. And then if there's a little bit of time, we may just touch quickly on the local option, the school improvement fund, and the construction tax that was passed last session. Hopefully, you'll get enough of an understanding from the discussion this afternoon so that you won't have many questions to ask me during the session, and that will make my job a lot easier. So,
it's all about making your job easier.
That's my purpose this afternoon. Trying to get you up to speed and refresh your memory, those of you who have heard it before, and try to fill in some blanks for those that may be hearing it for the first time. The big picture is about teaching about 565,000 students, the employing of over 60,000 staff, operating over 1,300 school sites by way of 197 school districts. So it's a pretty big operation when you look at it from a statewide viewpoint. But this is basically what's being funded, what the state school fund dollars and local school dollars are supporting. There will be three levels of equity that we'll mention this afternoon. First, the division between all school districts relative to the division for all ESDs. And then for the school districts, how does it get divided up between the 197 individual districts? And the ESD pot, how does it get divided up among the 20 ESDs? If we start out with the state school fund, whatever that appropriation might end up being, there are a few uses and grants out of the state school fund that I refer to as off the top. Right? They have to be set aside for targeted uses. Then whatever is left, you add the school and both school and ESD local revenue to that, and then that gives you the total amount of funds available for allocation through the formula. Right. Once that total is determined, then it's split 95.25% to school districts, 4.75% to education service districts. Then if you subtract the local revenue for each of those entities, you get their school, state school fund share. So that basically is the process for calculating how much of the state school fund school districts get, how much ESDs get. Their local revenue is taken into account in that process. For the 07-09 biennium, the state school fund is about 68% of the total, property taxes 30%, and other local 2%. And those are the percentages out of about $8.8 billion for the biennium. All right, let's go ahead and move into the formula then. The formula is sometimes thought of as being about things that it doesn't really include. It's not about a general cost reimbursement, although it has some cost reimbursement component to it. It's not about entitlement in terms of dollars per student or adequacy or stability or anything about outcomes or achievement goals or test results. Nothing in the formula says school districts have to have certain quantities of inputs or use a certain mix of inputs. Nothing about quality or accountability. So a lot of the current discussion around school finance really isn't incorporated into the formula because it came before a lot of this discussion even took place. All right, well, what is it about then? It's basically about defining school equity or school district equity or fairness. What it tries to do is to measure the relative need of one school district relative to to every other school district. Given that each school district has certain kinds of students, certain kinds of district characteristics, given those characteristics, what is their need relative to a neighboring district that has a slightly different mix of characteristics? Then it reflects the finance issues and court decisions from the 80s because it was adopted in 1991. And then equity is occasionally refined over time by legislative policy. There were certain principles set up in 1991. One was to share the funding sources statewide, let each district decide how to spend its allocation so that minimize the number of categorical grants, to primarily adjust funding for uncontrollable cost differences, although you can argue about whether a cost is uncontrollable or whether the district has some control over how much that cost is, and then try to avoid incentives that would increase the district's allocation. So try to set some limits and minimize the opportunity for districts to game the system and try to increase their share of the allocation. So that leaves a very simple form of the formula to be state revenue plus local revenue equals the sum of four grants: a general purpose grant, transportation grant, high cost disability grant, and facility grant. Initially, there was just a general purpose grant and transportation grant. Since 91, the legislature has added the high cost disability grant and the facility grant. Okay, for the state school fund, current biennium, it's 89% general fund, 11% lottery, for a total of about $5.98 billion, assuming that it stays at that level. All right, I mentioned certain uses off of the top. The appropriation is used to fund small high schools, state special education, virtual schools, business practices, etc. All of these relatively small amounts were set aside last session for a specific purpose. Initially, there was just primarily two of the small high schools and state special education, and then last biennium or two, the number has gradually increased. The governor's budget has about the same number, although not an identical list. And then in the second year of the biennium, without additional funding, that list would get shorter in the governor's budget.
Steve, why do you have virtual school listed twice? Are those two items?
No, I'm sorry. That's a mistake on my part.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
Hadn't picked up on that. Thank you.
Checking to see if we were awake.
It's a test.
So far, we're...
Local revenue that's included in the school formula, operating property taxes collected. Note that this is collected and not imposed. So whatever taxes aren't paid in the current year aren't included in this, but any taxes collected based on prior year property taxes is included. So the prior years help make up for what isn't collected out of the current year taxes. Common school fund dollars, county school fund, federal forest related revenue, that's the secure rural schools dollars, state managed county trust forest, the Tillamook and the Clatsop state forest primarily, and a little bit of ESD local revenue that's to be distributed to school districts, and just a very, very minor amount of in lieu property taxes. So these are all statutory sources, and it excludes other revenue, such as if there was any gifts to a school district, if anybody willed the school district money, those kinds of funds are not included as
Steve,
formula revenue.
Senator House has a question.
Thank you, Steve. What is ESD excess local revenue?
Madam Chair, Senator Haas, when ESDs were fully included in the formula, the amount that some ESDs get from the formula is less than their local revenue. And so the question was, do they get to keep that excess local revenue or does it have to go somewhere else? And it was the intent of the legislation, although there's some debate about whether the legislation actually does this, was for that ESD excess revenue to be distributed to the component school districts that make up the school, make up the ESD. So if the ESD wouldn't get to keep it, it would go back to the school districts.
And then, Steve, you're probably getting to this, but all of these are kind of folded into the equalization formula.
Correct. These are the only ones that are folded into the formula. The relative shares, property taxes, about 92%, federal forest, about 2.4%, and the common school fund, 3.6%, out of roughly $2.7 billion for the biennium. So you can see the importance of the property tax relative to the other sources. All right, going back to the formula now, we want to look at each of the individual grants that we've talked about, state revenue and local revenue. We want to go into some bit of detail for each of those grants, and we'll start from the right and move to the left. The factors that come into account in the formula are the weights, student weights for various student characteristics, a teacher experience adjustment, and then transportation costs, high-cost disability students, and new facility costs. Each of those three have their own grant. The student costs and teacher experience are in one grant, the general purpose grant. Okay, facility grant equals up to 8% of construction costs, and it's up to, because there's a biennial limit of $25 million that the cost cannot exceed. The $25 million has always been reached, so that there has never been an 8% facility fund grant to date. It's been like 3, 4, or 5%. It just depends upon how much construction value comes into place or into use in the biennium, what that percent ends up being. Can't be used for construction. It's for equipment, primarily, that can't be bonded for because of the bond restrictions that were adopted in the measure 49 or 47 and 50. And the cost cannot include land for the facility. So it's furnished, basically furnishings and equipment that are the costs that are included for this facility grant. The high cost disability grant, let's see, yes. Again, up to equals up to eligible costs above $30,000 per disability student. Another grant that's limited, this one to $18 million per year. Initially, it was somewhat, initially the $30,000 was $25,000, but that included a sum above $18 million, so the decision was, well, let's raise the limit to $30,000, reduce the number of students that are eligible, reduce the paperwork, and get closer to 100% for the $18 million. If they're above $18 million, they're prorated down equally. The transportation grant equals 70% to 90% of approved transportation costs, and we'll touch on what those costs are. But districts are ranked by their transportation costs per student from high to low. So those districts that are in the top 10% of that ranking get 90% of their costs included in the formula, the next 10%, 80%, and then the bottom 80% get 70% of their transportation costs included in the formula. Before the 80% and 90% were adopted, every district was treated at 70% included in the formula. The costs that are included are for transportation of students between home and school, elementary if they're more than a mile away, secondary if they're more than 1.5 miles away from the school, and then for various other academic uses and for preschool handicapped students. And in a few cases, room and board in lieu of transportation. The chart, bar chart, shows you the growth in transportation costs over time, and then gives you the ratio of the non-formula 30% to the formula 70%. Okay, the general purpose grant is the main driver, so this is very important in terms of how the districts qualify for the general purpose grant. It's equals weighted students times the $4,500, which is adjusted by a teacher experience factor, and then that combination has to be balanced to the available funds. You have the sum of the four grants, and you have the state and local revenue. Those two quantities have to equal each other. The way it's done is that the general purpose grant has a number times it to make the sum of the four grants equal available revenue. Okay? And you'll see that clear, I think, as we go into this. The $4,500 was just a target set in 1991. At the time, funding was under $4,500, and the goal was to try to reach $4,500. Since we're way above that now, that is taken care of by the ratio being more than one. It started out being less than one. Now it's about 1.3 to make those two amounts balance each other. Formula of student counts. ADM, you'll see that in some of the information you have. It stands for average daily membership, with kindergarten at half weight. That not every state uses this. Some use a fall enrollment number. Some use ADA, or average daily attendance, which would not include those who don't show up for school. But then we use ADM, and then a weighted ADM adjusted for student costs. And then in the formula, it's an extended weighted ADM number, which is the higher of the current year or prior year ADMW. Now, when you hear the term, someone say ADMW, they're probably talking about extended ADMW, because that's the formula use. Okay? We just don't use the word extended all the time. But what these different measures do is to make it difficult to compare per dollars per student amounts, because you don't always know what measure is being used for those dollars per student. Is it dollars per enrolled student? Is it dollars per weighted student, et cetera? And so you have to be clear about what the measure is, and that's why you'll see varying amounts, dollar amounts per student in various, from various sources. And it's not always clear what the measure is. The extra weights for various students. The individual education program has an extra weight of one, total weight of two. Students in poverty, an extra weight of 1/4 for a total of 1 1/4, et cetera, on down the list. So these are the weights then that are assigned for special education and at risk. Some of them are group weights. The Department of Human Services provides a measure of students in neglected and delinquent homes. The department then, or the district then, uses that number. The district isn't doing the identification itself. The IEP extra weight. Currently, IEP students are 13.3% of the total ADM statewide. The law limits the extra weight to only 11% of the ADM without a waiver, without going through a waiver process. Initially, the statewide average IEP was 11% of students. And it's since grown to 13.3%, but that 11% cap is still in the statute. There's only 33 of the 197 districts that are below the 11% and 156% above. So you can see how the number, or that the number of districts that are above 11% are by far in the majority. The waivers are granted for about 4,600 IEP students. And so those that are above 11% go through an application process, qualify for waivers. That then means that about 89% of the IEP students have an extra weight. The 1/2 weight for English as a second language, currently about 128 districts report ESL students. and they're about 10% of ADM. Most districts are using 03-04 data in a report I did in the 05 interim, showed that only 12 districts report a cost more than the value of that extra half weight. One of the problems is that, I think, why there's so few is that it's probably fairly difficult to track ESL dollar costs that the district are expending on those students. It's probably easier to track those for the IEP students. So that if this were somehow connected to actual costs, I think you would see those costs, a better recording of what those costs are, and there would be fewer districts, or there would be more districts reporting costs closer to the dollars associated with that half weight. But again, it goes back to, well, how accurate are these weights? When they were decided upon in 91, there was a lot of professional judgment involved in setting what that weight was, because there wasn't a lot of good data to follow at the time. The relative size of the groups, special education has about 70,000 students, English as a second language about 53,000, poverty by four, the largest group at over 82,000. But then again, when you think about the size of the weight, special education gets a full extra weight, but English as a second language is only half of that bar in terms of the extra weight, poverty only a quarter of that bar, so that special education has the highest additional weight count of those groups. There's some other student cost weights. Kindergarten, of course, is at one half. There are a few elementary districts that get weighted at 0.9, and then the Union High School district that those elementary districts are in has a weight of 1.2. Those are such that if you combine the elementary and Union High School students together, it would be the same as though they each had one weight. So it's just a recognition of the elementary costs probably being a little bit less than what the costs are at the high school level. And then we have weights for remote small elementary schools and small high schools, and those vary depending upon the size of the school and the number of grades served, and we'll look at that next. To qualify for the small high school additional weight, the school, we're talking about individual school, not district here, has to be in a district with less than 8,500 ADMW. The location has to have been unchanged since 1995, and it has to have been a small high school in 1999, and have fewer than 350 students for four grades. So it's not possible for a high school to now become qualified. A small high school may have qualified, after 1991, grown in a number of students to be more than 350 for the four grades, lost its small high school qualification, but then have a reduction in students that would requalify it. But if it's a high school that had more than 350 back in 1999 or wherever, and now because of changes in the population that has dropped below 350 for their high school, they can't qualify because they weren't small back in 1999.
I'm just kind of lost in the last two bullet points.
Okay.
Just explain what those mean, please.
Right, the 350?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. To be a small high school, the number, your ADM for that high school has to be less than 350, which means you have about 80, you have to have less than an average of about 87 students per grade to qualify.
And does that mean if it's a four-year high school, is that what the four grades mean, versus the next bullet is if it's a three-year high school?
Yes.
Okay. Now I understand.
Okay.
Thank you.
Sorry.
Thanks for clarifying that, because I was a little confused, too, on that one.
I think all of the small high schools are four-grade high schools, 9 through 12.
Steve, could you go back to the slide before that? I was a little... The elementary district students, so when you talk about Union High District students, are you talking about a specific school district?
Yes, there's... Harney County has elementary school districts and a Union High School district.
Uh-huh.
So all of the elementary districts are in that Union High district.
So this is, that the 90 and 120 pertains to only one school district, right?
Well, there might be a few others, one or two others. Harney is the only one I'm aware of.
But it's for small schools?
Yes.
Okay. All right.
Well, no, they wouldn't have to be, they wouldn't have to be small schools. They have to be an elementary or a Union High School district.
Oh, I see. So where are you? You mean where the whole district is just elementary school?
Yes. They still exist.
Oh.
They're not a unified district.
Oh, I see.
They're not a K-12 district. It's a holdover to some, the way a lot of districts existed prior to unification through the merger process.
Okay, so Ione School is one of those, right? In elementary.
I think Ione is unified.
Unified?
I believe so.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Senator Morris.
Thank you. Steve, is it a political issue or is there some educational objective principle that prohibits a school that falls below the 350 threshold by virtue of economic conditions and but yet they can't qualify for that small school assistance? Is there some rationale for that?
Madam Chair, Senator Morris, the rationale is legislative policy, I guess. I think if you went back and looked at the history, you would see some of these constraints were put in place to probably encourage mergers as small school districts.
But there's no objective rationale. It's rather subjective.
Rather subjective, but I think probably the overall intent was to encourage efficiency through mergers of small schools and school districts.
Probably.
Thank you.
The die is probably pretty well cast for mergers.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, I think, probably.
Okay, the small elementary school qualifications are very similar. The ADM has to be below 224 for the 8 grades, 1 through 8. But there's also a distance requirement for elementary schools. It has to be more than 8 miles to the nearest elementary school to qualify as a small elementary school. There used to be a distance requirement for high schools, but one of the last two sessions that was removed. But it still applies to elementary districts.
And by physiographic conditions, you mean like a great big river between something, between
right.
two schools or something?
Or I have to go over a pass.
Okay.
How much is the added weight? This tries to give you a feel for it. If you have a 4th grade high school that has 175 ADM, the one in the center of the graph, and if you go up to the blue line at the top, right, it adds about 89 additional student weights to the school's weighted student count.
So that's about a half, a little less than a half per
yes.
student.
Right. And as the school gets larger, that phases down to zero additional weights at 350 for a 9 through 12 grade high school. Okay. And similar but smaller numbers for grade schools, and again, depends upon how many grades are in that grade school. Just a quick look at how the student counts have changed over time between ADM and ADMW Extended. The extended count is about 20-some percent higher than the ADM amount. Okay, teacher experience. Remember that $4,500 target amount? The teacher experience adjustment increases that $4,500 by $25 for each year that the district's average teacher experience exceeds the state average. The converse is also true, that if the district's experience level is below the state average, it subtracts $25 for each year that it's below the state average. Okay. So the $4,500 then will be different after that teacher experience adjustment for districts.
How big a swing does that cause in a typical district? I mean, I have no idea how different districts would stack up. How much of a swing would you have?
Madam Chair, for most districts, it's very small. Plus or minus a couple of years, probably. But then if you have a very small district that has maybe two teachers and they both have 20 years experience, it can be fairly meaningful.
So would you say on balance this weights the formula towards smaller districts?
Not generally. That would be an exception and not even a general rule for small districts. This has not much of an impact. I mean, the $25 was set back in 1991 as being about the average cost for a step increase for one additional year of teacher experience. It hasn't been increased since then. And, you know, if you were recalculating that today, it would probably be close to $75. Mm-hmm. So it's just a holdover that hasn't been changed. It was there to help districts that initially, after 1991, had higher paid teachers, more experienced teachers, and it was felt that when the formula was adopted, there should be some compensation to adjust for that because they couldn't immediately go out and get rid of the more experienced teachers, hire less experienced teachers to be at the state average. Okay. But given the time that has elapsed since then, there has been time to do that kind of adjustment to have the experience distribution that the district wants to be able to pay for. Okay, so restating the general purpose grant now in a little bit more detail, we have the extended ADMW times the $4,500 target increased or decreased by our teacher experience factor. And then that is times a balance ratio, currently about 1.3 some, to make the funds available equal to the sum of the four grants. Okay. So here we have it with just the additional information. What I'd like to do now is to just take a few minutes to do what-if scenarios with the formula as you see it there. For example, if districts approve bonds for new construction and districts then apply for increased facility grants, what happens? Does that affect all of the other districts? Since the facility grant is capped, it doesn't affect all of the other districts. It just affects districts that qualify for the facility grant. So basically, it would make more money, more districts available, and reduce that percentage then that each of those facility grant districts would receive. Okay. Same with the high-cost disability grant. Since it's capped, if there's additional high costs eligible, it doesn't affect all the districts, it just affects those that qualify for that particular grant. Transportation costs, if they go up, price of gasoline has been a lot higher last year. Can expect those costs to go up. What happens? The transportation grant will go up because of the fixed percentage of those costs being included in the formula. Given that we're assuming that state revenue and local revenue hasn't changed, something else has to give. The general purpose grant then has to go down to compensate for the increase in the transportation grant. And it does that by having a lower ratio, balance ratio, so that the four grants still equal the same amount of the assumed state revenue and local revenue.
Run that by again.
Okay. Transportation costs have increased. Mm-hmm. The percent of that, of those transportation costs consequently increase, the transportation grant dollars. Assuming that there's no increase in state dollars and local dollars, and the facility grant and the high-cost disability grants are both capped at their maximum, mm-hmm. then the increased transportation costs have to come from the general purpose grant.
So each district we get just a tiny bit less?
Yes, per weighted student. That's the interaction of how the grants are formulated.
And are you, what counts as transportation costs?
All of those approved costs, the home to school mm-hmm. 1 mile for elementary, 1.5 for high school. Athletic transportation does not count.
What about districts? Some districts transport kids, like elementary kids, who are less than a mile. When they do that, what happens? Do they still get?
Yes.
They still get transportation costs for that?
I believe so. But they have to do it when it's more than a mile or a mile and a half. Mm-hmm.
And there's no there's nothing in place to require any kind of efficiency or anything like that. It's just whatever they say they spend on transportation. They get the money?
Chair Burdick, the Department of Education oversees what they report mm-hmm. and makes sure that it's used for an approved cost. But the only thing that really controls how much, other than that, how much they spend is that 30% of it is coming from the district. Or at least 30%. So that's one of the criticisms of the transportation grant, that if they become more efficient and reduce their transportation costs, they basically benefit just 30 cents on the dollar saved. Mm-hmm. And there is a transportation study that was made this last interim that will be available in. And they're still making some final corrections and editing to it before it's finally released.
Now that's a 70% to 90% of transportation costs. Who gets 90% of their costs?
The districts that have the highest cost per student.
That's right. That's
in that
right.
ranking.
That's right. Okay. All right. Thank you. Big distances.
And the other what if is, let's assume that local revenue remains unchanged, but state revenue goes down, right? Which might be reality. What happens? Transportation grant doesn't change. That's a fixed percent of their costs. The other two grants are capped out. So they don't change. So all of the reduction comes out of the general purpose grant. Okay. And the way that happens is that the balance ratio has to decrease so that there's fewer dollars for each weighted student included in that general purpose grant calculation. Okay. Any questions about that then? Yeah. You are now experts. The formula distribution, general purpose grant is over 95% of the total. So you can see from that how important those student weights are. Because that's where most of the money is. Transportation is a little less than 4%. And the other high-cost disability and facility grants is less than 1% of the total. Well, together, they don't even make up 1% out of roughly $4.1 billion. So the weights are extremely important in terms of how much each district is going to get for their share of the total. All right, just a couple slides on history. You have the bar graph that shows how much of the total was state school fund, how much was the local dollars, and then the white area at the top of a few of the bars is other money, being school improvement money, or before the school improvement fund, it had some other names, but those amounts were outside the formula and pretty much always distributed on a per weighted student basis.
So that doesn't include local option?
Does not include local option. Okay, then the same information on a per student basis. You can note that there are a couple of years when the amounts per student declined, 02, 03, and 04, 05. So history may repeat itself, but if it has happened before. The equalization results chart shows you the impact of the school equalization formula. If you went back to 91-92 and you looked at revenue per weighted student, you would find that it varied anywhere from roughly $3,000 to maybe $9,000 or $10,000. Not all the districts are included here, just to keep the dimensions of the graph boundaries a little bit smaller. Then if you put the 06-07 revenue per weighted student, you get the almost horizontal line, right? Kind of a sawtooth line there. The sawtooth indicates the differences per weighted student because of transportation costs being different, teacher experience being different, or the high-cost disability grant, and the facility grants being different per weighted student. So those just make minor changes on a per weighted student amount. So much more being alike per weighted student. But it's taken quite a long time to fully implement the equalization formula. It took 10 years, but this is the kind of results that you receive, that you see as a consequence of that process. Any questions about that before moving on to education service districts?
Yeah, because I'm having trouble understanding the graph. The graph includes each of those little blips as a separate school district, or
yes.
How does that work?
Madam Chair, that's correct. And they're ranked by order of revenue per weighted student in 91-92.
So the horizontal axis is not, Madam Chair, is not time.
It's districts.
Okay.
So what this is trying to show is that in 91-92, some districts might be getting two or three times the revenue of the district with the least amount per weighted student.
Okay, I get it now.
So there the difference was in thousands of dollars. Now it's in hundreds of dollars per weighted student, what that difference is.
And that's equalization.
Okay. Yes.
Thank you.
Moving on to education service districts. The thought behind the way education service districts are funded is that they provide services to school districts so that the ESD costs are related to the costs of the school district, and the school district formula takes into account those costs. So why not use the same, in effect, the same weights for ESDs and make ESD revenue proportional to the formula revenue of its component school districts, rather than develop a whole nother formula. So it was decided to take this approach and keep it relatively simple. So for ESDs, there's a base revenue calculation that's about 4.98% of the formula revenue for all of the component school districts inside that ESD. Remember, ESD's got 4.75 or 4.75% of the total. The school district's got the 95.25%. The 4.9% of the 95.25% makes then is equal to the 4.75%. The reason this has to be more than 4.75% is because it's being applied to the 95%, not the 100% of the total. Does that make sense?
Did somebody actually invent this? Or did it just was appeared out of chaos?
The school formula has had a very interesting journey through the process.
I'll take some responsibility for this. So the general formula then is that state revenue and local revenue equals the higher of $1 million or the base revenue adjusted so that available funds equals available dollars to be distributed. So that percent to balance serves the same function for ESDs as it does for school districts, to make both sides of the equation equal.
So are there, how many districts are getting the 1 million who would be lower under the first criterion?
There's five ESDs that qualify for 1 million.
And roughly what would they be getting if they were under the other system?
About a third less. The $1 million, depending upon the ESD, works out to be roughly, I think it was $600 or more per weighted student. $600 to $900, something like that. The percent of base revenue is a little over $300 per weighted student.
Okay, so I presume these are far-flung rural districts that fall into that category?
There are five districts in Eastern Oregon.
And they're too far apart to be consolidated, I presume?
Not all of them.
Uh-huh.
Well, I think two are share a boundary of the five. Mm-hmm. But they could all be felt. They could all potentially be merged with an adjoining ESD.
Senator Morris, do you have any follow-up questions on that?
Not right now. Thank you, Madam Chair.
I said that with reluctance.
Okay.
The ESD revenue pattern follows that for school districts, only the lesser amounts. What I wanted to point out here is that you look at the first bar on the left, 1991, it was all ESD local revenue. There was no state support of ESDs prior to that 91-92. All right, just a few comments. Local option property taxes. It's property taxes. What the local option language does in statutes is to exclude it from formula local revenue unless it exceeds a certain amount. Okay. If it's more than the local revenue has to be the lesser of these three, the available gap dollars, 20% of formula revenue or $1,000 per student times the number of students. If it exceeds the 20% or $1,000, then there's a recapture process. Anything above that amount, you know, assuming that the gap was large enough to raise that amount, anything above that then would have to flow back to the local revenue formula, local revenue for the school district.
And I can presume that that's never happened. Is that correct?
That's correct. Yeah. Let's see. Well, I take that back. There may have been one occurrence, I believe I ran across, where it did exceed it. Whether it was recaptured or not, I can't say.
And
it was a minor amount.
Yeah, okay.
Local option elections haven't been real popular. About 41% have passed. That may change with the voting dates and turnout requirements.
Do you remember who passed the first one in 99? Was that my own city of Portland? It was Corvallis.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure it wasn't Portland.
Corvallis, I think
it was Corvallis.
Yeah. Okay.
There's also a local option equalization function that's kind of complicated, difficult to explain. But what it's trying to do is guarantee a district that makes a local effort as measured by its tax rate can raise as much money per student as the district that has more property value per student. So if the district at the 75th percentile can raise $1,000 per student with, say, a 75-cent local option tax rate, then all of the districts that have less value per student should be able to raise the same amount as that 75 cents. So there is an appropriation providing some general fund, state general fund dollars to provide equalization for the local options.
And has that been used?
Yes. There are typically 3, 4, 5 districts that qualify. And I would expect that number to increase.
Okay, and the money is outside the formula.
Correct.
The special appropriation, does it have to be reappropriated every biennium?
That's correct, Madam Chair.
Okay.
Okay, just a quick comment on the construction tax and school improvement fund. The construction tax was passed last session. It can be imposed by a school district without voter approval. It just takes a district resolution. It has to be used for capital improvements. The rate can exceed $1 per square foot for residential construction and 50 cents for non-residential. But there's also, again, a limit of $25,000 on the non-residential per permit or structure. That is the only, well, probably the only tax rate that is indexed. Not the tax, but the rate is indexed to potentially increase over time. And then there's various exemptions in the statute. School Improvement Fund, won't really say anything about that other than when the School Improvement Fund was first adopted, school districts got it all, 100%. And then that was recently changed to where school districts would get their 4.75% just as they get 4.75% of formula revenue and the local revenue pot. And it's distributed proportional to weighted students.
Okay, run that by again. Let's see. The school improvement fund, don't they have to apply?
They do have to apply, yes. And there has to be a report to the legislature by the Department of Education.
Mm-hmm. And how is that distribution worked out statewide?
The districts that apply and are approved, they're spending the money for activities that increase student achievement. then the Department of Education calculates an amount per weighted student, and then that times the number of weighted students in the district is their share. All right, just a few comments. What I wanted to try to do is take the governor's budget dollar amounts and apply the process that we have gone through to those dollars to show you the application. All right, the state school fund, $6.39 billion in the governor's budget, zero school improvement fund. The question is how that $6.39 billion then gets divided up. Categorical grants of $34.7 million come off the top. The balance then is available, the $6.356 billion is available for school districts and ESDs. All right, if we take that $6.35 billion on the next page or slide, add $3 billion of local revenue to it, we now have $9.356 billion K-12 and ESD equalization revenue. Okay, so that's our big pot. All right, what we then have to do is take that $8.9 billion, divide it up, the 9.356. We have to divide it up between schools and ESDs, add the school local formula revenue, their share of that $3 billion, $2.8 billion, so that the K-12 equalization formula for school districts then has $8.9 billion available for the biennium. Right, you have 6.1 for school districts. The ESDs get $255 million out of the state school fund for their, and they have $188 billion of local revenue for a total of $444 million. That 444 is their 4.75% of the total. So that's how things are divided up, and everybody's happy.
Okay, how about taking the bottom slide on page 80 and the top slide, or slide number 80, compared to slide 81. I don't get that, how you go from 9.356.
All right, of that 9.356 billion dollars, mm-hmm. 95.25% of it is for school districts.
Oh, got it. Okay. All right.
That gives you the 8.912.
So you broke it down between school districts. I got it.
Yes.
Okay. All right. Wow, that's a lot of material. Now I know why I never see you when I come down there. I'm always hiding out with your pencil. Any questions from the committee?
Too confused to ask questions.
No, really. Thank you very much. This is a lot of complicated stuff. And on behalf of the committee, I will say no dice to your premise that we won't ask any questions in the future. Okay. Anything else from the committee today?
I can mention one thing, Madam Chair. It's just we are planning a meeting with the House Revenue Committee on Friday. And the Senate committee is invited to attend that. During the February session, the committee introduced Senate Bill 1082, which required Department of Revenue to do a report on tax compliance. And they've done some estimates on the extent with the personal income tax of potential noncompliance, some of the behavioral factors behind that. And they have a detailed report for you, and they'll go through that with both committees on Friday. And, Madam Chair, if you'd like them to come back to just this committee, we could do that, too, in the next week or so.
Okay. Well, I would, given our tight deadlines and everything, and given the priority that I'd like this issue to have, any committee members that can make it at the middle of the night on Friday morning, 8 o'clock. I'd encourage you to do that because it's important stuff, and we probably will have to schedule another one if we can't get it done Friday. So I will be there.
I'll be in district.
Yes, she'll be in district. Okay.
What time on Friday, Madam Chair?
They meet at 8 o'clock.
8 o'clock.
Yeah. Which used to be the time that Senate mm-hmm. revenue met, so count your blessings.
That's 8 a.m.
Yes.
Okay, any other business before the committee? Thank you. We are adjourned.